This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Yet another dangerous global warming feedback has been uncovered in the Arctic. It's nitrous oxide, the greenhouse gas that doesn't get enough respect. Yes, the major driver of climate change is carbon dioxide, at 63% of human-induced emissions. Methane is next at 17%. Nitrous oxide, more powerful but more rare, lags behind, counting only 6% of greenhouse gases from people's activities. Two things. With our future climate on a knife edge, that 6% could tip us into changes difficult to survive. And, like carbon dioxide and methane, nitrous oxide emissions are rising steeply in the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution and accelerating. 6% of a rapidly growing total burden becomes a larger and larger amount. So what is nitrous oxide? It is a gas where two nitrogen atoms are bound tightly with one oxygen atom. For humans, nitrous oxide is used in dentistry as a pain reliever and for sedation. It is actually an asphyxiant. Strangely, nitrous oxide also triggers the laugh reflex. It is laughing gas. Nitrous oxide was discovered in 1799 by a 20-year-old chemist, Humphrey Davy, and he and his friends soon tried it out for a giggle. In the 1800s, traveling medicine shows and auditoriums blasted whole rooms full of people with nitrous oxide to create uproarious crowds. It still returns periodically as a hip party thing, but remember, nitrous oxide is a dangerous asphyxiant that can be deadly. One other thing, according to Wikipedia. Quote, a 2009 study suggested that nitrous oxide emissions was the single most important ozone-depleting emission, and it was expected to remain the largest throughout the 21st century, end quote. So it's not a good thing to have more of it. The basic element nitrogen is cycled through soil, plants, and our bodies, and then back into the atmosphere. The process of nitrogen being captured by microorganisms is called nitrification. When those microorganisms or other ones release it again to make a gas, that is denitrification, where it unites with oxygen, escaping as the potent greenhouse gas nitrous oxide. Here is the new wrinkle. Until recently, science agreed the big plays in the nitrogen cycle are in the tropics. The Arctic has lots of nitrogen frozen in the soils, but it lacks the microorganisms that would free it. Well, thank goodness for that. But new science finds a warming Arctic and thawing permafrost. Serious nitrous oxide emissions are starting up. That means humans can emit even fewer greenhouse gases before we lose our livable planet because we have this northern feedback loop developing. So let's get to that new science. You hear about carbon dioxide and methane flowing into the atmosphere as permafrost thaws. But there is more. Nitrous oxide, the greenhouse gas we hardly ever hear about. It is pound for pound 300 times more powerful for warming than carbon dioxide. Nitrous oxide stays in the atmosphere for around 114 years. Humans induce about 43% of nitrous oxide gas reaching the atmosphere. The rest is natural, so to speak. But nitrous oxide from natural sources is getting a boost as the northern top of the planet thaws. New science published December 2021 in the journal Nature explores vast lands where powerful greenhouse gases emerge in what could be a positive climate feedback. Dr. Maya Marushik is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Jyväskylä in Finland. She authored and co-authored dozens of works on the Arctic. From Finland, Maya, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for the invitation.
How much warming comes from nitrous oxide in the atmosphere?
Nitrous oxide is the third most important greenhouse gas after carbon dioxide and methane, and its contribution to the global warming caused by greenhouse gases is about 6%.
6%?
Yes.
Okay. Is nitrous oxide increasing in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide and methane are?
It is increasing. And it is increasing more rapidly during the past four decades than it was increasing before. So compared to pre-industrial times, it has increased about 20% or a bit.
That's quite a bit. There's a lot of nitrogen reappearing in the Arctic as the permafrost thaws, but previously scientists considered Arctic nitrogen less important than emissions that could come from the tropics. What has changed?
That is very true, that traditionally people haven't been very concerned about permafrost nitrogen. And there is a good basis for thinking that in Arctic this nitrous oxide doesn't matter so much. That is because Arctic is very cold environment, as we all know, and you have a lot of nitrogen in the soil, as you have a lot of carbon too. But it is there, quite well conserved by the cold temperatures and also by permafrost, so really locked from the microbial decomposition. And it has been so before that the nitrogen availability is so low because of the slow nitrogen mineralization from soil organic matter. So the availability for microbes and plants of nitrogen has been really low earlier. But now Arctic is changing very rapidly, as we know. So it is very quickly warming, twice as quick as the global average, or locally it can be even 3 times or 4 times quicker than the globe is warming. And that is causing big changes in this nitrogen availability from soil organic matter. So this nitrogen mineralization, which produces the mineral nitrogen that can be used by plants and microbes, that is now increasing. And also this permafrost nitrogen that has been locked from decomposition, that now becomes available when the permafrost thaws. And now there can be more nitrogen available that can be immediately used by plants and microbes. And this can cause now the leak to the atmosphere as nitrogenous gases, including nitrous oxide.
It can be difficult to grasp what this is about. So you led the new paper published in Nature December 7, 2021. The title is Thawing Yadoma Permafrost is a Neglected Nitrous Oxide Source. What is Yadoma?
Okay, Yadoma is one of the most important permafrost types that we know. So there is permafrost peat and then Yadoma, which contain very huge carbon pools. And Yadoma, that means these kind of fine-grained, organic-rich sediments that were accumulated over large areas in Siberia and Far East Russia and Alaska and Yukon during the late Pleistocene, so the last ice age. So most of the northern hemisphere was covered by ice sheets. But between those ice sheets, there are these mammoth grasslands. So they were dry and cold environments where wind-blown sediments were accumulated. And after the accumulation, they were quickly frozen. And that's how Yadoma has been generated. And it occurs now as these very thick deposits. So it can be several tens of meters, so even 50, 60 meters deep deposits of this late ice age organic material. And when that thaws, then this carbon and nitrogen from Yadoma becomes available for microbes.
Is the Yadoma the actual wedges of ice that is stuck in Arctic land, or is it the landscape that contains those icy wedges?
So Yadoma means these deposits, so this kind of soil material, fine-grained soil material that contains then carbon and nitrogen. And you mentioned the ice wedges, so they are something very characteristic for Yadoma. When Yadoma was accumulated, it was this kind of polygonal mammoth tundra where it was accumulated, and typical for this polygonal tundra are that it forms these ice wedges, so big clumps of pure ice that are formed in cracks in the soil. So Yadoma consists of these Yadoma sediments, sediment material, and then these ice wedges of pure ice. And why these ice wedges are important? So they don't contain so much carbon or nitrogen, but they make Yadoma very vulnerable for thaw. So when Jeroma thaws, these ice wedges, they are melted away, so it's almost pure water, and they can comprise even 85% of the total soil volume in these Jeroma sediments. So when those ice wedges are melted away and the Jeroma also thaws, a big volume disappears with those ice wedges, and that causes very catastrophic thawing and ground collapse, which can then reveal very deep soil profiles completely in a short time. And in our recent study, we really studied this kind of Jeroma exposure, so collapse sites where tens of meters of Jeroma are exposed in riverbanks.
Is there a lot of this nitrogen-rich Jeroma in the world, and where is it?
Yes, there is a lot of Jeroma in the world. So the Jeroma region covers more than 1 million square kilometers across the northern hemisphere, and it occurs over large areas in Siberia and Russian Far East and Alaska and Yukon.
And there's another common misunderstanding, and it's beautifully addressed in your new paper. To find past atmospheric conditions in the deep past, we know that scientists measure gases trapped in bubbles in the glaciers. But the nitrous oxide you warn about is not just ready sitting there in bubbles, ready to rise up from thawed ground. Please describe the process required after the thaw when nitrogen can go airborne as nitrous oxide.
This is a very good question, and it brings us to the main players of these permafrost feedbacks to climate change. So, the microbes. In our paper, we could very nicely link the microbial community in this thawed Jeroma sediments with these nitrous oxide fluxes. So we noticed that right after thaw, Jeroma sediments, they don't produce a lot of nitrous oxide. But it takes about 10 years when the sediments are dried and stabilized and revegetated. And together with these changes, there are big changes in the microbial community. And we saw increased abundance of those functional genes which contribute to nitrous oxide production in the soils. There are two main processes producing nitrous oxide in soils, nitrification and denitrification. And we found increased relative abundance of these nitrifier genes that produce nitrate. And then we also found increased abundance of denitrifier genes, which then use the nitrate to produce nitrous oxide. Yeah, these are very interesting dynamics, what happens after permafrost thaw, because often it's the case that permafrost is lacking some of the important functional microbial groups. But then in a real environment, the microbes can become abundant that were lacking in the first place.
It's kind of a small revelation, really, to me in your paper, because if you need the right set of microorganisms in the soil and they're not there when the ground first thaws, that kind of means that, like the birds and the fish and the plants, microbes are pushing towards the poles as the ground warms and thaws.
Well, this is kind of what is happening. It's not this kind of northward migration like can happen for the tree line or for the birds or some plant species, but it is so that what we find in intact permafrost before it has been thawed, that doesn't mean that nothing else can access there. So microbes, they can be moving within the ground with water flows, and they can be also dispersed by air. So more or less it is so that any microbial groups, they can start to thrive in this thawed permafrost with time. So depending on the environment, is it wet or dry, what kind of conditions are there? So the right microbes will find there. And with Jeroma, which is nitrogen-rich sediment, it makes sense that nitrogen-transforming microbes will find their way there. And in right conditions, they will start to produce nitrous oxide.
At the 2012 meeting for the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver, I was there. I listened to a conversation among permafrost experts. And even then, just 10 years ago, permafrost emissions seemed like a kind of obscure subject for experts, it would take thousands of years before anything much happened. But now we're seeing changes in a lifetime, and I find widely different predictions about the speed of permafrost thaw and when emissions will enter a feedback loop, etc. What are your predictions about timing?
It is true that the scientific community has known for some time that this permafrost carbon feedback will be there, but it is not there yet in the IPCC predictions. Like, permafrost is mentioned in the latest IPCC report, but the permafrost feedback is not yet in the models which are used to create those emission scenarios. So it's always that policymaking is lagging behind what scientific community knows. And besides that, we have still great gaps in the knowledge when we think about these permafrost climate feedbacks. And also, it hasn't been fully incorporated to these coupled carbon climate models. And here we are talking about yet another feedback related to permafrost. So it's nitrous oxide emissions. It's a direct feedback to climate change, but also this permafrost nitrogen that has great implications for the carbon cycle. Like how quickly this carbon will be decomposing in permafrost soils. That is affected by nitrogen because it's a main nutrient. And also the potential for Arctic vegetation to take up atmospheric CO2, so this cooling effect to climate. We know that it will happen, but it will be also controlled by the nutrient availability, also by nitrogen. So there is a lot to find out.
You know, a couple of years ago, NASA announced the process of melting and breakup of the massive Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica was, quote, unstoppable, not a word they use very often. Can we now say the same about permafrost thaw?
Yeah, I think we could say that because it is a process that is ongoing. It has been documented well that permafrost is thawing and these abrupt thawing events and all kinds of disturbances like wildfires and this ground collapse related to thaw, they are becoming more common. And these natural processes, when they have been initiated, we are like accelerating them with our greenhouse gas emissions. But these natural feedback mechanisms, they are something we cannot easily affect. So when they are in progress, they will continue and they will feed back to the climate change, even if we stop all our emissions.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from Finland is postdoctoral researcher Maija Marashuk. And we're hearing about a little-known global warming gas that is increasing in the atmosphere as the planet thaws permafrost in the Arctic. Is the amount of nitrous oxide coming from thawing permafrost significant now? And is there a way to really measure and know that?
So this, I have to say that no one knows, because this topic has been so little studied. And there is not a good monitoring network for Arctic nitrous oxide emissions. So there are no continuous monitoring stations in the Arctic who are measuring nitrous oxide. So now we just rely on these few observations, I can say maybe dozens of studies who have looked into Arctic nitrous oxide. But there should be a lot of work done with this topic in near future. Also, since there are so few observations, we cannot really model these emissions. So that's something that we are currently doing. So we are trying to now incorporate the knowledge from the observations to these biogeochemical models and process models. So we are collaborating with modelers there. But currently those models cannot predict these emissions. So a lot needs to be done. And also we don't know so well the distribution of these landforms. For example, these Yeromato sites, how abundant they are in the Arctic, because they can be quite small in the area, so they cannot be detected by many of the large-scale satellites. So this is something new, but definitely something that requires more research.
You also say nitrous oxide is, quote, a dominant contributor to ozone destruction in the stratosphere. Talk to us briefly about that.
Yeah, that's right. So this Montreal Protocol was a very efficient means to control the emissions of the ozone destruction substances, but N2O wasn't included in that protocol. And that's why currently when the CFC emissions have gone down, currently nitrous oxide is the most important substance which is causing ozone destruction in the stratosphere.
Your study found the right balance of soil moisture releases the most nitrous oxide, and I found myself wondering, well, how would that be affected if more Arctic precipitation comes as rain, as found in a recent study? Would that be a factor?
Yeah, that's true. So we have found, based on synthesis of nitrous oxide emissions from permafrost-affected soils, that intermediate soil moisture conditions promote N2 emissions. And that's the same as for the soils worldwide. And that is because then these processes that I mentioned before, so nitrification and denitrification, they can both occur at this intermediate soil moisture content. But it is very, very hard to say what is the net effect of this increased precipitation, because the local topography affects so much the local distribution of water within the landscapes. And also permafrost plays a big role, because permafrost prevents drainage, so it causes this waterlogging. So it can vary a lot in space what is the future of the Arctic when it comes to soil moisture content. But what I can say for sure is that any kind of big changes, they can boost these nitrous oxide emissions. So besides permafrost thaw, also draining of soils that has been previously very wet, that can boost N2 emissions when this nitrogen mineralization is increased.
In 2020, you co-authored a paper led by Carolina Voigt last year. Nitrous oxide emissions from permafrost-affected soils is the title. How does that paper fit in with your latest work?
Yes, that was the synthesis of all the nitrous oxide studies from permafrost-affected soils. And in this synthesis, we found out which were the most important factors leading to high nitrous oxide emissions from permafrost-affected soils. And these factors include, besides the intermediate soil moisture content that I mentioned already, this high nitrogen availability, and that's related to soil organic matter content. So organic soils like peat soils, they can boost high nitrogen availability. And also the quality of the organic matter. So carbon to nitrogen ratio, for example, is quite important determinant for nitrous oxide emissions. And besides these factors, also any kind of disturbances, like I mentioned before, so disturbed vegetation or lack of vegetation, that can boost nitrous oxide production, because when plants are not taking up any nitrogen from the soil, then more is available for soil microbes, including those producing nitrous oxide. So that was the knowledge that we used to build the hypothesis for this Yerevan work also. And our expectations were that we will find also the highest emissions from thawed Jeroma without any plants, so these recently thawed sites. And that's why we were quite surprised when we found the highest emissions from soils that had been already revegetated by some pioneering plants, so grasses and mosses.
So plants are playing a role. That's interesting. Maya, have you been to Siberia yourself to investigate the permafrost thaw and nitrous oxide?
Yes, I have been doing a lot of fieldwork in Arctic Russia. We are neighboring countries here, Finland and Russia. So the closest real waste permafrost areas to us are in Russia. So I have worked in Komi Republic in the European Russia, focusing on permafrost peatlands. And then I have went to Sakha Republic in northeastern Siberia to study these Yeroma sites.
And the thawing edge of permafrost is alien landscape to most of us. You are much closer to the Arctic Circle. Jyväskylä, Finland is just 481 kilometers or 299 miles south of that Arctic Circle dividing line. Tell us what it's like, this land of transition from long frozen ground to new landscapes.
Yes, this is something that we see also in Finland. So now I can tell about my last summer's fieldwork in northern Finland. I studied methane and carbon dioxide release from balsamires. And these balsamires are ecosystems which have the last bits of permafrost in Finland. So Finland doesn't have a lot of permafrost, but just sporadic permafrost, which is located in these peatlands, because when peat is dry, it isolates very well against warm temperatures, so it conserves the permafrost. But during the last decades, these balsamires have been degrading very rapidly, and I could really see it in the field. So I could see previous balsa vegetation, like these dwarf birches, which have been growing on the top of these frozen permafrost balsas. They were now underwater, submerged. And I also discussed with my colleague who has been monitoring these balsamires during the past 10, 15 years. And he was indicating quite large areas that were still having permafrost 10 years ago, but now they were underwater. So it seems that we are losing the last bits of our permafrost, maybe even during my own lifetime, and they are gone.
So what do we need to do to better monitor, to really know how much dangerous greenhouse gases are coming out of thawing permafrost?
Yeah, according to my opinion, we need more of these long-term monitoring stations across the Arctic, which also include nitrous oxide measurements. Because when we are talking about something that hasn't been studied before, it is very, very difficult to know if these emissions have been always there or if they are there as a result of recent climate change. So we are lacking this base case scenario. And to observe how quickly this process is happening, we should start monitoring those things now, and then we could observe the changes. And also with this increasing availability of data, we could incorporate this knowledge to models that we could use to extrapolate these observations over large areas. And then we could start to talk about magnitude of these emissions. And then we could also compare it with carbon dioxide and methane. So currently, we don't know, and we cannot really estimate how large this feedback will be.
So Maya, do you think that permafrost thaw could become a major driver of climate change, say as big as disappearing sea ice?
Well, it's hard for me to evaluate between these two, but definitely this permafrost climate feedback, that can be substantial and that can be a significant addition to the global emission budget. So now we are trying to mitigate the human-related emissions, and we are talking about these emission budgets that we still have left for a certain level of warming, let's say 2 degrees of warming. And if we don't incorporate in those modeling predictions this permafrost carbon feedback, we might miss something. So we might actually need to mitigate our emissions even more if we don't account for these natural emissions that will take place no matter what we do. So this is something that should be urgently done.
And what are you working on next?
I'm working on my data related to anaerobic decomposition processes that I have been studying 3 past years in University of Jyväskylä. That's data that has been collected and I will now publish next. But then I'm also very excited to continue on this permafrost nitrogen path, so trying to understand it even better. How large is the nitrous oxide feedback from permafrost, and which are the controls of it? Also incorporating our observations to the models and these large-scale estimates. That's something that my group is currently working on.
We'll be watching this permafrost From the University of Jyväskylä, Finland, we have been speaking with postdoctoral researcher Maija Maroschak. You can find links to all the science we talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.